Right now, I'm very happy to welcome to our program our friend Branko Marcetic, a Jacobin Magazine staff writer and author of the book, Yesterday's Man, The Case Against Joe Biden. And Branko's written some important articles recently in the pages of Jacobin concerning the victories of progressive and democratic socialist candidates in democratic primaries this spring and summer. And Branko, thank you so much for making time to be with us again this evening on Counterpoint.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
So during the Democratic Party primary elections this spring and summer, we've seen a slew of progressive and democratic socialist candidates emerge victorious in some major races for Senate, governor, and the House of Representatives. And I was just going to rattle off a few of them and then get to our conversation. So most recently, of course, we saw Dr. El-Sayed win the Michigan Senate primary for the Democrats. There was a Kansas gubernatorial primary that was won by a progressive. A lot of mess in Maine, but a progressive did emerge from the second primary in Maine. Colorado, Michigan, as we talked about, not just the Senate race, but state representative races as well. We had some real important victories there. New York local primary elections for state House, state Senate, Washington, D.C., and Los Angeles have Democratic Socialist candidates that will be running this November, and a key Pennsylvania House race as well. That's certainly not all of them, Branko, but I wonder if you would attach some significance to what we've seen develop with these progressive victories over these last several months.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a couple of things going on here. One is that the Democratic base has, in a way, I don't want to say they moved left, because actually, if you look at polling for a long time, the Democratic electorate has been pretty much in line on policy with, you know, what a lot of kind of progressive or socialist candidates are putting forward. But I think what you're seeing now is that the Democratic voter base is now feels emboldened and feels like previously they were worried about certain things like electability and that you know, you had to have a more centrist kind of candidate to win elections. And I think that idea has now come out of favor. And so you're seeing the electorate, the Democratic voters, actually starting to pick candidates that align with them in terms of what they actually really believe. And not just thinking about kind of trying to psychoanalyze some imaginary centrist voter. So I think that is playing a big role. I think another thing is that the Democratic establishment, which has previously been able to pretty successfully sort of dictate the way the election is going to happen, it's pretty successfully been able to sort of, for lack of a better term, discipline its own voters and sort of tell them, you know, which candidates they should really be voting for and picking. The Democratic establishment has really been delegitimized in the eyes of its own voters, not just because of the loss to Trump in 2024, that was major, but then also the decision after that to basically sort of take this approach to Trump that was widely perceived by the voters as kind of just them doing nothing, rolling over and playing dead, to use the term that Democratic strategist James Carville described what Democrats should do in the age of Trump. And so without that kind of disciplining factor, voters, I think, are a lot more kind of inclined to choose candidates that might not otherwise have gone with, and to sort of disregard the wishes of the establishment, you know, which we did see in Michigan. The last thing I would say that we're seeing is the way that the centrality of not just Israel and Gaza as, you know, just a major political issue, a central political issue in people's minds, but also the way that, you know, pro-Israel money and the pro-Israel lobby, the way that its kind of intervention in races has become its own issue, its meddling in internal politics of the United States. Previously, a couple of years ago, you had, you know, pro-Israel groups spending lots of money and they defeated candidates. And it was, you know, it was remarked upon on the left, but it got very little coverage otherwise. And I think what's happened now is that voters understand, you know, when UDP, United Democracy Project, is spending money, they know that that's AIPAC, and they know that that is money that they don't want to be influencing their elections. And so there's a lot more, this has become sort of an issue and an outrage on the sort of broad left of the spectrum. And I think all of that has kind of contributed to seeing this surge of insurgent candidates winning elections all over the place.
And I also wanted to add that we've seen cycle after cycle after cycle where Democrats get in, Republicans are punished at the polls, then it reverses. But I think for many people, their life situation doesn't change, you know, and there's a growing frustration that people see no solutions in either Democrats or Republicans. And I think that's why people voted for Donald Trump. He was seen as a disruptor, right? Somebody who was from the outside. And that may be the case, what we're seeing now in the Democrats, where people saying they're rejecting these traditional, safe, milquetoast candidates who promise nothing and do nothing. And they want somebody who's going to breathe a little fire, fight like hell, and at least make some commitments to things like Medicare for All that a growing number of Americans favor. I think that this kind of lean into being in favor of disruptive candidates is taking off on both sides.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there's also a shift in what people believe it is actually electable. The conventional wisdom for many years, decades really, has been that if you want to get a Democrat elected, particularly in a red or purple district, and particularly in a state that may not be, you know, that may have large rural and working class parts to it, that you have to kind of go with a candidate that is, you know, quote unquote moderate, that is more centrist on economic issues and social issues, and may pay lip service to things like balancing the budget and, you know, all this kind of thing. The left has for years said that actually, if you look at public polling, and there's, you know, through the years of robust public polling done on this, that's actually not really what the sort of median independent voter wants. It actually, surveys show that people want candidates that are sort of oppositional to the establishment, to the system. They want candidates that, as you say, are going to disrupt things because they're so unhappy. Then they want candidates that have an economically populist pitch, you know, support things like Medicare for All, support things like taxing the rich, support things like bringing down pharmaceutical prices and so on and so forth. That has been understood, I think, among the left. It's been understood among the people that do this kind of research, but it's taken a while to seep into the broader public consciousness. And I think what has happened is that the consistent failures of centrist candidates, the exact candidates that voters are told again and again, are the only ones that can win elections in these places. The failure of sort of centrist establishment candidates at the presidential level to beat someone like Donald Trump, that has been a clear and tough lesson for voters. And they've said, well, hold on, we have tried this and it doesn't seem to work. Let's try something that's closer to, you know, what we feel we want in our hearts. And that's being reflected in the voting choices.
We're speaking with Branko Marcetic, a Jacobin Magazine staff writer and author of Yesterday's Man. We're talking about some of his recent articles you can find on the Jacobin.com website. Recent one is Centrist Dems Really Do Hate the Left More Than Trump. And yes, the left won big last night. Talking about the Michigan Senate race, the Senate primary. In Michigan, Dr. Abdul El Sayed won an unexpectedly close race for that state's U.S. Senate nomination, despite being outspent by a large factor. The Israel lobby, you mentioned a moment ago, AIPAC, other conservative Democratic PACs played a significant role in opposition to El Sayed, but lost. And I'm wondering what that says about Michigan and the trajectory of where the nation is going.
Well, you know, I think we're going to see more concrete answers to that once the general election comes. But certainly, I think what we can definitely say is that this was a, beyond everything else, a firm rejection of the power of money in politics. Don't get me wrong. I mean, a candidate that has outspent 9-1, as El Sayed was, will most of the time lose. That is still a major disadvantage. If somebody can put that kind of money into just blitzing the airwaves with ads and you know, sending mailers everywhere and all the other stuff that money buys, I mean, that most of the time will bury a campaign. But I think what you saw with this election is that a massive, gargantuan amount of spending. You know, this was the third or second most expensive Senate primary race ever. It can be overcome. It can be overcome with, you know, determined organizing with grassroots action, with people, you know, spending their days and their weekends door knocking and talking to people. And it's really a triumph for the kind of direct democracy that groups like the Democratic Socialists of America and others, you know, that were involved in this campaign believe in. But the narrowness of that victory, I mean, remember, he was very up in almost every poll going in. So the narrowness of that victory does show that, you know, nevertheless, that massive amount of money still has an impact, even if it wasn't able to prevail. So, I mean, I think that should be a wake-up call, really, for just how corrosive this, allowing this kind of spending, unfettered spending to be used in elections is. But I think also, again, you know, it speaks to how much the Democratic electorate has shifted and how much of an appetite there is for, you know, not the same old solutions, but something really bold. You know, I mean, look, El Sayed, famously, he is not a socialist. He does not identify as a socialist, but he was endorsed by Sanders. And he, you know, what were his top planks? Medicare for all, taxing the rich, and the public ownership of data centers was also in there, among a few others. I think there's right now a battle for ideas for what's going to be kind of the at the crux of the future Democratic policy agenda. And you're seeing kind of, again, a dividing line between those who want a Medicare for all system and those who, you know, want more kind of tinkering around the edges. And I think it's clear that there is an appetite for, you know, a real comprehensive, you know, massive overhaul of the healthcare system that finally gives Americans the same thing that almost every other country in the world has, which is, you know, a universal healthcare system.
Well, now that Dr. El Sayed won the nomination, he's being viciously attacked in a blatant, hateful, Islamophobic campaign conducted by the Trump administration, Republicans in general, invoking fear and bigotry against Arab and Muslim Americans. I'm just going to play a short clip of an advertisement that's gone up on the air in Michigan recently. We can take a listen to that right now.
El Sayed pledged support for the leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, a designated foreign terrorist group. He wants to hike taxes on Michigan waitresses, delivery drivers, and seniors on Social Security. He joined a sex offender and a murderer to demand the mass release of dangerous prisoners. And when his ally claimed America deserved 9/11,
America deserved 9/11, dude.
El Sayed refused to disavow it.
I'm not here to disavow people's views.
Abdul El Sayed, too radical, too dangerous, wrong for Michigan.
So that was from a TV ad that I took off the net, and yeah, clearly they threw everything they could in there, everything but the kitchen sink. He kicks his dog too. I think they left that one out. Ridiculous. Yeah, what do you make of this campaign? It's over the top. Is, you know, just attacking people for their religion and the color of their skin. Of course, not surprising given Donald Trump's and the way he's conducted his presidency in a, you know, very uncompromisingly white supremacist agenda. But what do you think is going to happen with this line of attack, both on Dr. El Sayed and they certainly were going to repeat that all across the country wherever they can?
Yeah, I mean, I think it certainly smacks of desperation. It does not speak of a confident campaign that can actually debate on some of these issues. You know, I mean, Syed's positions, I think, are broadly popular. Medicare for All, again, you know, sort of opposition to data sets of construction. That stuff is really going to be what voters really care about. And the determination to not talk about that and just to sort of try and play to people's most base kind of hateful instincts, you know, I think reflects a little bit of the unwillingness to touch some of those topics. As for what it's going to do or whether it's going to work, I mean, I suspect, to be honest, that this may be a misreading of the American electorate. There isn't really many signs that you know, Americans, especially in 2026, kind of harbor these sort of hateful, bigoted attitudes. Don't get me wrong, there are many people who do. Is it a majority position? I'm not sure it is. It's a very different country from even, you know, 20 years ago in the post-September 11 period. And in fact, we just saw primaries the next day, you know, one of the most Islamophobic, bigoted members of Congress who was endorsed by Trump ended up losing the Republican primary. So, I mean, if a Republican, a Trump-backed Republican who is coasting on his hatred of Muslims cannot even win a GOP primary, that cannot even take him to the top spot among Republican voters, I find it difficult to believe that this is going to work among the electorate as a whole in Michigan. But we'll see. Perhaps I'll be proven wrong.
Well, we're out of time, Bronco, but thank you for spending time with us tonight, and your commentary on U.S. politics is weird, strange, and abhorrent as it sometimes is. thank you for being here, and leave our listeners with, well, the Jacobin website, where they can find your recent articles and any other resource you want to throw out there.
Yeah, Jacobin.com, and, you know, I would also say InTheseTimes.com, another great resource, and ResponsibleStatecraft.com, which I write for occasionally, foreign policy commentary.
Oh, yeah, the Quincy Institute. We've got folks
from
there all the time. Hey, much appreciation for spending time with us tonight, Bronco. Appreciate it.
Of course. Always good to be with you. Thanks.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
That's Bronco Marchetique, Jacobin Magazine staff writer here on Counterpoint.